Hey there, sex fans. Welcome back. Today is Wednesday, July 20th, 2011, and you're lucky enough to be listening to the podcast edition of Dr. Dick's Sex Advice with an Edge, with your host, that savagely scintillating sexologist, Dr. Dick. That's me. Acclaimed author and British kinkster extraordinaire, John Smith, is back with us today for more of his signature sex education. John, as you recall, is the author of Kink and the City, An Englishman in New York. His infectious humor was so delightful last week that I was thrilled that he could come back and knock us dead again this week. And to guilt the lily, so to speak, John will read a hilarious section from his book. You do not want to miss this, sex fans. But wait! You did get to listen to part one of our chat, right? Well, not to worry if you didn't, because you can find it and all of my podcasts in the podcast archive on my site, drdicksexadvice.com. All you gotta do is use the search function in the header, type in podcast number 290, and voila! But don't forget to use the pound sign when you do your search. To buy John's book in either hard copy or e-reader format, simply click on the book art posted in today's podcast posting on my site. Today's podcast is brought to you by the ideal sponsor for this kinky series, Dr. Dick's Stockroom. You'll find this treasure trove of sexually stimulating toys, implements, and fetish wear and gear right there on the front page of drdicksexadvice.com. Look for the Dr. Dick Stockroom banner in the sidebar of my site. You'll surely enjoy shopping at Dr. Dick's Stockroom because it's just so damn fun and, I might add, easy. Yes, sir, sex fans, you can spare yourself the embarrassment of skulking down to your local sex emporium to pick up all those nasty toys you've been drooling over. You can forget about seedy storefronts in unsavory neighborhoods, and you don't have to worry about leering salesmen scrutinizing what you buy. Why? Because you shop from the privacy of your own computer. That's why. Thanks to Dr. Dick's Stockroom, it's never been easier or more discreet to be a big fat pervert. And be sure to take a moment out of your hectic schedule and visit my stockroom today. You will be so glad you did. Okay, on with the show. John Smith, welcome back to DrDickSexAdvice.com. I got so much wonderful feedback from last week's show, and everybody's dying to hear more of you and from you. So let's launch right back into it. The premise of your book, and correct me if I'm wrong here, is that you arrive in New York City after the demise of a relationship of long-term, 15 years as I recall, and this is your story about how you try to rediscover and reintegrate yourself, rediscover your kinky roots and reintegrate yourself into the scene. That's correct, yes?
That's absolutely correct. I had an eight-year break after that outbreak. So it's arriving in New York after an eight-year break, trying to break back into the sort of the kink stroke spanking scene.
Right. And but I gather that you've been a kinkster and a pervert since you were a puppy.
Sadly, yes. it's an uneasy lies ahead that wears the crown. I was sitting in a school playground when I was 8 years old, and with a girlfriend, a friend who was a girl, and we were just talking away, and I was eating a Mars bar or something, and she suddenly started talking about the fact that she fantasized about spanking.
My
reaction at the time was, I beg your pardon? And she just carried on for about 20 minutes, and by the end of 20 minutes, I was excited and motivated, but I didn't know quite why. And I was definitely forever changed in those 20 minutes, and she made me think about these things that I never stopped thinking about. There, obviously, as I said in the book, I'm not sure whether or not she lit a fire or she built the fire and lit it in that time. But definitely, that was a turning point for me. So after that, it was, you know, it was something I thought about all the time. And I never looked back, basically. But I didn't start doing anything for many, many years later. And the book details the fact that part of my life when I first discovered, you know, there were spanking magazines. And when I first time I saw a spanking magazine in the store, I was just like, oh my God, I am not alone, you know.
Because there's our whole magazine full of folks. Just
I couldn't believe it. It was a revelation of
how old were you, Bob?
And unfortunately, they were nightmarishly expensive.
Uh-huh.
And you know, of course, you know, teenage boys smuggle girly magazines, or they did in those days, into their houses. I had to smuggle bloody spanking magazines into the house, and the thought of being caught with one of those at 12 years old, was, you know, I'd have been shipped off to, you know, military school or something, and you know,
where you would have gotten spanked a lot. So
no
thanks,
doubt,
parents.
Yeah. Although we don't have military school in England, I'd been shipped off somewhere, and I'd had electrodes attached to my genitals, and you know, and all sorts of aversion therapy. But I was never caught, and I left home at 16 and rented a room from a woman, very nice woman, who was 20 years older than me, who it turned out was a professional dominatrix.
And they say there is no God.
Yeah, well, somebody else once said to me, that sounds like a, you know, every schoolboy's wet dream, and it, of course it is, but I was so young at that stage. I had a tremendous relationship with this woman. I was 16, she was 36, and she gave me the whole kink 101, but only in terms of talking about it, mm-hmm. because I was so young then and so inexperienced, I regarded myself merely as a top. So a number of times that she asked if I'd like to play with her, and she was suggesting was that she was going to top me. Right. And as I wasn't, I didn't think myself as a bottom, I said, no, I'm not interested. And of course, I look back now and go, are you nuts? Are you mad? Uh-huh. I mean, you know, a 36-year-old woman playing with a 16-year-old boy, where was her mind at? Well, we know where it was at, and good for her. But so it wasn't quite the schoolboy's wet dream it sounds, but it was certainly an education.
Well, that in itself is, I mean, learning from somebody who actually knew what they were talking about must have been better than, you know, trying to figure it all out on your own or from your peers who were equally as ignorant as you.
Exactly. Bear in mind, I am rapidly approaching what I would define as middle age, from the wrong distance. And back then, there was no internet. There was the odd spanking magazine. There was not the plethora of information available as now.
Yeah.
So, I'm 16. Am I going to admit to a 16-year-old girlfriend that I'm kinky? Not in hell, you know. So the exposure to her was very, very valuable. And she taught me basically everything in terms of thought process and whatever. And then a year later, I left, and I still didn't play for about 5 or 6 years because
right?
Yeah, because.
But it was part of your fantasy life. I mean, was this jerk off material?
What an unpleasant way of describing fantasy.
You know,
what I mean?
Let me just rush right in there with that question.
Woody Allen said, "Don't knock masturbation. It's sex with something I love."
Exactly.
Also, you haven't got to look your best for it either.
That's right.
But yes, that certainly was an activity that I indulged in on a fairly regular basis whilst thinking about this something and perusing magazines. Yes, that was the only outlet at that time.
Interesting. Did you ever see the brilliant movie Personal Services with Julie Waters?
I was first in the queue when it was released.
I
knew about it. The woman upon which it was based, Cynthia Payne, was very famous in the UK. And yes, I did see it. And it was actually directed by Terry Jones, who was the Monty Python team. And a fun story, a slightly sad story, but it was a good little movie. Yes.
Well, I recommend it to everyone in the audience. Personal Services with Julie Waters. It's absolutely brilliant. So funny, I just nearly peed my pants. Don't you know? So you are fond of saying a good kink is like fine wine. What do you mean by that?
It's expensive.
Oh, God, I love it. Absolutely.
I shouldn't laugh at my own jokes. What I mean by that is sometimes you'll get a scene that is so good, it transcends day-to-day reality, and it's almost spiritual, and we've touched on this previous conversation, and it is like savoring a fine wine. The atmosphere, if the person you're playing with is as skilled or has the same headspace as you, the interchange you get through whatever it is you're doing is beyond delicious. And that's why I describe it as being like a fine wine. I'm not a wine aficionado myself, as long as it doesn't come in a box, it's good enough for me. But you know, amongst fine wine connoisseurs, they talk about the same sort of, you know, esoteric feelings about when that something hits them perfectly hard. And I had certain scenes which have stayed with me for, you know, weeks afterwards, so good has it been in quality. So it's my analogy, if you like, as to what good play can be like.
Is there anything else in either in your life or that you know of that would be its equal?
That's a very good question, actually. No, I don't think so.
Yeah.
It transcends everything else. I mean, I regularly meditate, and I have certain experiences in meditation which are transcendental, but it's a different sort of feeling.
Right.
No, nothing else gets me quite like this does.
Because it involves so much of us. I mean, sex is one thing, and it's wonderful, and I like it a lot, don't you know? But this whole BDSM thing is so much more encompassing. I mean, it involves thinking and emotion and physicality and intellect and all of those things that, you know, a regular, you know, bump in the hay just doesn't involve.
That's right. I mean, and obviously, as you know, good sex can be fantastic. It can be brilliant.
Yes.
For good sex, but.
Yes.
I get a deeper connection doing this stuff. I get a lot deeper connection, and I say it lasts longer as well. And when you're out there riding the ragged edge, topping or bottoming, you're in uncharted territory. You really, really are.
Right.
And sometimes you can completely lose yourself in what's going on. And I find that fascinating. If I'm bottoming, there's one particular person I bottom to who's extremely competent, extremely safe, but good God, she will take you all the way.
Yes.
So there's a fear factor because she scares me, but that's
part and parcel. Yes.
Yeah, that's part of it. But it's countermanded by the fact that I know I trust her implicitly, but I know she'll go all the way, and that scares me.
Yes.
And that's part and parcel of it. It's the fear. I like that, and that's also like fine champagne to my mind, and part of a good scene.
Right.
I'm not a masochist. I mean, we haven't really discussed.
Is that
this.
Right?
In this conversation, we haven't really discussed in this conversation. I am both a top and a bottom, and my main activity is corporal or discipline. Call it what you will, whether it be whipping or spanking or caning. I am absolutely not a masochist. I don't like the pain.
Yeah.
I hate the pain. But I love the anticipation of what's going to come. I love the feeling afterwards. But unfortunately, you've got to go to the middle bit to get there.
And so unless
you do it for real, then you're not really doing it. So that's my particular thing.
Interesting. I want to talk to you a little bit more about that very thing in a minute. But right now, I want to talk to you a bit about how difficult it was for you to enter into the scene again after this hiatus of 8 years, and I suspect, and you alluded to this actually, that connecting with potential play partners had changed considerably in the interim. How and why you connect with people had changed.
Yes, it's the internet, of course.
Yes.
I arrived in Manhattan with a sort of a briefcase, a laptop, and a stupid grin, and that was it. And that is, what do I do? So, you know, I sat in front of the net the first day I was there, and I literally, this is absolutely true, I literally Googled Spanky Manhattan.
Oh, and I
thought, you know, what the hell? And the first listing that came up was an advert on Craigslist.
Uh-huh.
And I never even heard of Craigslist, basically with a picture of this woman's delightful cherubic bottom, saying that she would bottom for hard cash.
Wow.
And I'd never even thought about paying for it. Cut a long story short, and I describe this in depth in the book, I went along to see her, and we did a scene together, it was great fun. And then she explained to me how it all worked, all the various sites and forums where very sad people like myself would post themselves, hoping to get meets and whatever. And I embarked on the gargantuan task, the epic task, of posting myself on various sites looking for people to play with, and skinning my knees on a number of occasions before I got to where I wanted to go. But eventually, I, through considered effort, I sorted out the wheat from the chaff.
Yes.
And then good play partners recommended me to other play partners. But actually getting there was like manhandling a mattress up a spiral staircase. or if not more difficult, single-handed. But that's how I did it. And you know, eventually the good people recommend you to other good people.
Right.
And that's it. But it requires a level of persistence and a thick skin.
So, John, could I prevail upon you to read a little snippet from your book?
Okay, well, the bit the section I'm going to read from you was shortly after I'd met the young lady who explained to me how the scene works in New York, and she explained to me that I ought to post myself on a number of sites, and I did, and it was a disaster, and I refined the advertisement, and eventually started to get some replies, and this particular chapter starts off with me returning home and opening my email box to see what responses I'd had to my posting.
So, delicious.
The chapter is called, or this is part of the chapter, is called Dear God. I wouldn't exactly say my cup totally overfloweth per se, but upon returning home after a short business trip, to see 13 responses to my post was certainly encouraging. Kink-wise, I was clearly rising like a phoenix from the ashes. I'd neglected to remember, however, that Phoenix was also the name of the tutor of Achilles, who had a terminal weakness. With ill-disguised excitement, I clicked on the first letter and started to read. And I read, and I read, and I read. 5 pages into the explicit account that were this woman's labyrinthine desires and fantasies, I began to feel a little jaded. I felt even more jaded when I noted I was only on page 5 of a staggering 19 pages. She described a scenario of such intricate detail, it would have had Tolkien throwing away his first manuscript of Lord of the Rings as too lightweight. Her imaginative scene, complete with a detailed script, had a tragic grandeur of truly epic proportions. Homer's Odyssey was a mere pamphlet in comparison. Sadly, I'll never know how the torturous storyline ended as boredom took over, and I realised I could never afford the costumes or hire the required Nubian slave army. I said thanks, but no thanks. Number 2 started off with, as a larger woman, which is as far as I got, thanks, but no thanks. The next one had a photo attached, which I opened before reading the letter. Inexplicably, it featured the correspondent inserting a carrot into a body orifice that was a fair distance from her mouth. Totally mystified about how this related to my post, it went straight into the bin. Number 5 also featured an attached photo, which, very warily, I opened. I was confronted by a picture of a naked woman of almost skeletal proportions. I've honestly seen more meat on a butcher's apron. I say woman, that's really just pure speculation, as the aforementioned individual had so many body piercings scattered around her, it was almost impossible to ascertain gender. Her letter commented, I'm attracted to older men. I think she really meant magnets.
Good Lord.
I concluded if I played with her, I spend most of my time worrying about lightning strikes. I said thanks, but no thanks. Recognising I was nearly halfway through, I felt the first hint of discouragement. I clicked on the next reply. Number 6 started off swimmingly, a short, intelligent note from someone who clearly understood this stuff. We were of like minds right up the part where she said, so, if you'd like to come to Vancouver, I said thanks, but no thanks. Number 7 informed me that she was a figging enthusiast, which had me totally mystified. A quick check online revealed this was the eye-watering practice of sticking a root of ginger up under one's back passage. Now, I've got no inherent problems with a tradesman's entrance, but combining it with a stemmed vegetable is unappealing. I briefly considered inducing her to correspondent number 4 before I said, thanks, no thanks. Number 8 unkindly informed me that I was a misogynist arsehole who was going to burn in hell. In fairness, I suppose she was 50% accurate. The next respondent described themselves as a passable transsexual, which made them sound like a dinner table condiment. And the next was from Taiwan, written in the most appalling English. She earnestly informed me that she much enjoyed feelies. I didn't know exactly what feelies were, but I had a fairly good idea and was pretty sure they had little to do with strict English discipline. The remaining 3, however, showed real promise. One was New Jersey-based, which, to my internal credit, I didn't hold against her, and 2 were in Manhattan. I sent about writing back. Some weeks and numerous emails and telephone conversations later, appointments had been arranged for all 3. The women in question were all late 30s and gave good accounts of themselves. From what they'd said, they'd had experience, albeit nothing close to Chloe, but understood what they were getting into. The first was due at 3 p.m. on the Monday. The phone went at 2:30. "I'm awfully sorry," said woman number one. "The elevator has broken down in my apartment building, so you'll understand I'm a bit marooned until it gets fixed." I understood totally. Walking downstairs in a high rise is one thing. Schlepping back up is quite another. "No problem," I murmured comfortingly. "What floor are you on, by the way?" There was a moment's hesitation. "The third," she confessed. Warning bell sounded like an imminent air raid. I wrote the next day cancelling. No kink is better than bad kink, or even worse, fat kink.
Ha. Huh.
Woman number two walked over my threshold and introduced herself in a haze of frankly questionable perfume and a gushing over-familiarity which had my toes curling so much I felt like I was wearing Arabian slippers. Her choice of attire was frankly challenging, and the jeans size she'd selected to try and squeeze into was an ambitious choice. Whilst her dress sense was certainly courageous, physically, it has to be said, she was something of a challenge. On the plus side, she sported a chest that caused me to duck whenever she turned suddenly. Alas, the same could be said of her nose, a most unattractive appendage giving her a hawk-like appearance reminiscent of an American eagle. Whilst definitely no oil painting myself, I only made these less than chivalrous observations as she was rather less than complimentary about me. Looking me up and down like a piece of meat, she observed that I really didn't make the best of myself. God knows what happened to the polite woman I spoke to on the telephone. I put it down to nerves. Remembering the specifics of her scene preferences, I took her left earlobe between thumb and forefinger and led her to the bedroom, muttering, "You've asked for this, young lady." Upon reaching the bedroom, she said, "Would you like to see a photograph of my previous disciplinarian?" "Now," I said with some surprise. The photo was already in her hand. An enormous bear of a man wielding a paddle confronted me. Not quite sure how to respond, I was formulating a suitably neutral reply when I felt her hand grab me between the legs, and I heard her giggle. "Uncle always gave me a good fucking after he spanked me," she said. An enduring image for some, perhaps, but not one that interested me at all. Looking at the guy, it must have been like having a heavy clothes locker fall on you with a key still in the lock. Talking of doors, I showed her mine on the spot. She vanished quicker than dignity at a sci-fi convention.
You are so marvelous. Thank you for that. I truly appreciate it. You identify yourself as a switch. Could you elaborate on that for those in our audience who don't know from Shinola?
A switch. That's somebody who enjoys topping people and also enjoys bottoming as well, i.e. receiving as well as giving.
I see. Good. Do you have a preference for one or the other role?
I would say that I'm probably 85-90% top.
I see.
But if I find the right top myself, I can spot a fake at 5,000 yards, you know, through thick fog, blindfold. But if I find the right top, I will bottom up. And I do enjoy it. But it's the intellectual dynamics have got to be right.
Right. And speaking of which, since you are a switch, could you address the different kind of high associated with each role?
I can. I'm sure a lot of your listeners will be familiar with this, but if you're bottoming, the intellectual dynamics can be fairly complicated. Some people like the humiliation of it. I that's not my thing, but
right.
What I get out of it, the fear factor, the fact that somebody else is in control, the fact that I have no choice about what's going to happen. It's certainly the captive syndrome, and also when the beating or whatever is over, you get an endorphin rush. You
right.
get to this scenario, which is referred to as subspace, which is almost a transcendent zone, whereby someone could beat you all night, and you would just say carry on because your endorphins are pumping so highly.
Right.
And the intellectual scenario of subspace is well documented, and a good scene can give you that.
Yes.
Topping, once again, you can there is something called top space, mm-hmm. which is not necessarily achieved so easily, but you can if you've got a quality play partner that can really take what you're dishing out, and you get into that dynamic with them, you can get to a situation where you almost intellectually are in a trance-like situation dealing out what you're dealing out, but you still have the caveat inside you about safety, and you're still
right.
watching for signs of distress, real distress.
Right.
But you get into a certain zone, and I've occasionally experienced that as well. So Both states are extremely pleasurable.
Because and when you're topping and this happens, it's because you have this simpatico with the one who is bottoming, yes?
Yes, because you're thinking to yourself, or you're, what's going, that you think they can really take what I'm giving out, and you can see that they're giving themselves up for it. They're distressed, but they're not distressed in a bad way. They may be sort of crying their eyes out, but they know that they can stop the scene at any time by just simply saying stop. So that they're where they want to be. They're enjoying it, and you're up in the ante, and you so you're comfortable. They're enjoying themselves, and therefore you're getting off because you're really being where you want to be. You like to dish out what it is that they want, and if they can take an even greater intensity, then you get that simpatico dynamic that goes on, whereby it's almost a symbiotic relationship at that stage.
Right.
Where you both literally are edging yourself up a greasy pole, excuse the analogy. But
ooh, you're making me just faint away here with this.
Pity.
Greasy poles? Whatever do you mean?
I have no idea what you're talking about.
So listen, I want to talk to you now a little bit about the difference between being a submissive and the act of submitting or bottoming, and I think you've just alluded that a bit. And it seems to me that this is more than just a psychological or a headspace. Am I missing something?
A delineation I make in the book, and it's something that's become very, very apparent to when I started playing, is in terms of people bottoming. They bottom for an infinite number of reasons. Generally speaking, my experience has said that they can be delineated the two sorts. There are submissives and submitters. Submissives will generally submit to a can of beans if it's got leather on it. They're looking for something to submit to. They're like, and I don't mean this in a negative way, they're like puppy dogs.
Yes.
You know, for God's sake, somebody leave me, somebody dominate me. And that's what gets them off. And yeah. I get that, it's fine. On the other hand, the people I tend to prefer to play with, and where I am when I'm bottoming, are what I call submitters. Mm-hmm. They are very fussy about who they will bottom to.
Yes.
Because they are giving themselves up and saying, okay, I am prepared to give myself up to you because I trust you and you've got what it takes. But, you know, I'm not going to kiss your boots or, you know, lavishly lick your boots. If you can't top me properly, take a hike.
Mm-hmm.
That's a big difference, and the women that I tend to play with are like that. They're normally very, very competent, professional women who, you know, you meet them in the street. They're, you know, lawyers, people in Wall Street or whatever. These are not submissive women, but they have this aspect of them that they want to give. They want to step out of that role for an hour or 2 hours or whatever and give it all up. And there's a distinct difference, and I put myself in that category as well. Does that answer the question for you?
Yes, it does.
Because I can't be extensive in the book, actually, in terms of my views on these things. I find submitters, I'm not interested in playing with a submitter. I don't want a woman, you know, on her knees in front of me. Mm-hmm. If she's a submitter and I make her do it, then that's a different dynamic. Right. I don't want someone that wants to do it.
Interesting. Because you said something before that you are not a masochist, and that triggered a remembrance on my part. And I was thinking back to I just have dabbled on a very little bit in the whole BDSM scene, and it's very interesting to me. And one of the things that I know about myself is that I really like the stimulation. I mean, almost the extreme stimulation that is all very attractive to me. But as soon as somebody introduces, you know, a verbal denigrating kind of rap, you know, like "you dirty faggot" kind of thing, that ruins the entire thing for me. I'm just like, okay, well, I'm done now.
Well, no, Richard, I'm with you on that. If anybody uses bad language when they're topping me, that's it. I mean, it rarely happens.
Yeah. Well, you work that out beforehand, don't you? Or do you just assume that the person that is capable enough to work with you would already know that?
That's right. Exactly right. We're all different. I mean, there's this one particular guy I know who's Jewish who loves being called a dirty Jew. I mean, mm-hmm. it gets him going. And fair enough, that's his thing.
Right.
I loathe that sort of thing, but there again, I'm not him.
Yes.
the verbal dynamics is extremely important to me if I'm bottoming. Mm-hmm. And anything towards bad language or anything towards anything I don't like just completely turns me off. But you know, and so I understand where you're coming from. But a lot of people love that.
We can't
criticize other kinksters. I mean, you and I know that. Frankly, if you're a balloon fetishist, you're mad as a hatter. We know that. Adult
babies. I know, I do.
Adult babies. I mean, really, get a grip. Yeah. But seriously, I respect it. If it gets off, great.
Absolutely. I totally agree too. And you know what? Just because it doesn't turn my crank, it doesn't mean that it doesn't turn somebody else's crank. But at the same time, my experience has been, at least for the dilettantes in the scene, is that they've learned a lot of this behavior from watching porn, and then they think that this is the only way the only way to dish this out is by having this verbal abuse along with the physical stimulation, and somehow they just can't break the two things apart because they've never seen it happen in porn.
Well, this is actually very interesting. I did an interview some time ago with a guy who said something along those lines, in so much as he said a lot of men... I'm fortunate. I've been playing since my early 20s, and I've never been, apart from the 8 years hiatus I had, I've never been in a situation whereby I desperately wanted to play, but I couldn't play with anybody because I was in a vanilla relationship or something. So he made this point that a lot of people, a lot of men, especially men, get their lead from BDSM porn, which is now obviously widely available on the internet.
Yes.
Now I'm not a big surfer of the internet in terms of porn. I'm just not. And the BDSM porn that I have seen, which is very little, I just think it's just such utter rubbish.
Yes. But
people learn from that, and they think. And the other point that this guy made was that men think that they should act a certain way in front of dominant women. I mean, what is a dominant woman? A dominatrix is not a dominant woman. She's getting paid to dominate you. So, you're giving it out the minute you walk in the room. So there are very few people, women out there, who are the true manifestation of the word dominance.
Right.
And
you would know it if you were there. So,
well, that's
play
right.
Acting.
Just tell. Some people have got it and some people haven't. And some people can command respect walking into a room. Some people can't. Some people just had the ability to shut you down with their eyes. Some people don't. To the man who has wanted to play for years and years and years and wants to have that whole dominant woman experience, when he actually gets in front of them, he's not sure how to act. Oh, it's a dominant woman. And this particular interviewer, a lovely guy, was saying that he used to get excited even emailing a dominant woman. He's like, oh my god, I'm emailing a dominant woman, because it was part of his growth factor, and he eventually learned that they're just like anybody else.
Right.
So people do learn from bad porn, basically.
Right. The best lessons, though. I mean, you learn something, but is it is it uplifting? Is it the good stuff that you're supposed to be, consuming, or is it just dreck?
Well, my recommendation to anybody getting involved in the scene for the first time, and this is the way that I played it when I got involved, re-involved, and I really mean this, is just be yourself. Unless, of course, you're a total arsehole, then don't be yourself. But just be yourself. People will gravitate towards you who appreciate your qualities or don't, and they'll know you for the real person. I mean, that doesn't mean to say you can't play hard, but just be yourself, because you can play a role when you're playing, but you can't play all the time. And I think men tend to think of dominatrices as getting up in the morning, cleaning their teeth, and putting their leathers on, when in fact they're probably sitting there in curlers having a cigarette. I'm being flippant, of course.
Boy, are you going to get it when you're finished with this interview.
I know. But I think in terms of ways to act, just act the way you would in any other social situation.
Right.
Be attendant, be polite, be courteous.
And so that's actually good advice for the novice who is just trying to break in or to feel his or her way through all of this, because there is a great deal of protocol and etiquette and all of this kind of stuff. But if you're honest and forthright and say, you know, I don't know what I'm doing, but I feel like this is something that needs to be expressed in me, wouldn't most people have a kind word to say?
Well, if you go to the right social events or you meet the right people, you'll be guided. Uh-huh. And as I got to know people in New York, I was fortunate. I connected with some yeah. good people, yeah. And who, you know, basically recommended me other people, and I got to meet, you know, the crown jewels, if you like, of the scene in New York. And I did that simply by being myself and learning and, right. and if I didn't know something, I would ask,
right.
And not being crass and not gawping and, you know. Just act as you would in a normal social situation. I mean, you wouldn't be lascivious in a certain normal social situation. So why would you do it in a at a kink party? It's decorum, respect, looking at people's boundaries. Just because there's a couple whipping the crap out of each other in the corner doesn't mean to say you can just walk up there and say hi. You know, it's about recognizing how to interact with people as a human
right.
being, I think.
Right.
That was a bit loquacious, wasn't it? I went on a bit there, didn't I?
But it's good information and good advice, because this is new territory for lots and lots of people, and I know a lot of people in my audience are the only interest, or excuse me, the only exposure they have to this whole thing is through this series, and it they are the richer for the tuning in.
Well, the other bit of advice I would give is, and this is really heartfelt advice, and it would be echoed by a number of people, try and stay in shape.
Interesting. Okay.
I mean, it's the old story about, you know, I met this wonderful girl last night. She was one of these amazing people who could eat anything she wants, and yet still not find a boyfriend.
You know, I love it.
People like to play with other people who are in shape.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I appreciate that if you're you know, in mid 40s and you haven't played before, you probably can't spend 3 nights at the gym a week. I understand that, mm-hmm. but people prefer to play with people who are better in shape physically,
mm-hmm.
And you know, no. And the better shape you're in physically, the more you're going to play.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like once again in the vanilla world. The better you look, the more partners you're going to get, or the more
right.
sex you're going to get.
Right.
The better shape you are, the more kink you're going to get, because more people are going to want to play with you in shape.
Right. How interesting. Yeah, because it seems to me that, you know, there's a wide range of body shapes and, you know, sizes and age groups and all of that kind of stuff, you know, that I see, you know, in the kink world here in Seattle, and we've got a very vibrant kink scene. And but it's true. I mean, certainly in terms of the professional people that I know, they are in extraordinarily good shape.
I rest my case.
Yes. So what does the future hold for you? Is there a follow-up to Kink in the City?
I have started playing around with one. Yes, I've been asked to write a follow-up, and I'm working on something called Cosmopolitan Kink.
Oh.
And it's going to be basically pick up where Kink in the City left off, i.e. some of my traveling adventures whereby Kink's been a component. And trying to was talking more depth about some of the fairly colourful characters that I've met, and because it's all about the people that you meet, and you meet some amazing characters. And you know, I've always felt that kinksters should have their own Masonic handshake, so you can meet them far more quickly. Because the kinksters that I know are in the main fascinating people. They are people I would not normally have had the opportunity of meeting,
mm-hmm.
Generally speaking. You know, I mentioned the airline pilot. You know, okay, there's a smattering of doctors and lawyers there, but there's a very well-known artist in there as well.
Mm-hmm.
There's a couple of very well-known writers as well, and these are fascinating people.
Right.
And you get the chance to meet these people because you share an interest. You know, some people share an interest in stamp collecting. Ours is kink.
Yes.
And I'm glad it's kink and not stamp collecting, frankly. But that's what I wanted to try and get across in the second book about some of the interesting people that you meet.
Cool beans.
But still maintaining that humorous edge.
Good, good, good. Well, with that, sir, our time has come to a close again this week. We are extraordinarily grateful for you being so generous with your precious time. We are richer for the experience. Thank you for being so forthright and humorous in your forthrightness, because that really makes a day for me. Before we go, can you tell us again where we can buy your book?
You can buy it from Amazon in paperback or Kindle download, Barnes & Noble online as a paperback or a Nook download, Borders as a hardback, as a softback, and Kaboo download, and most stores will order it for you.
Cool beans. With that, sir, thank you again, and we will be visiting you at least in stores to buy your book until we speak again. Thanks a lot, John.
Thank you.
Great show, huh? Well, that's it for today, sex fans. Tune in next week, Monday, for a special Q&A show and more Sex Advice with an Edge with your host, me, Dr. Dick. Again, this week's podcast sponsor is Dr. Dick's Stockroom. Listen up, you guys. If your sex life needs a little sprucing up, and whose doesn't, I want you to mosey on over to our online sex emporium and pick out something really naughty for yourself or one of the other pervs in your life. I mean, if you can't find what you're looking for in my stockroom, you'd better just call off the search right now. Dr. Dick has put together a dazzling array of products that will liven up even the most ho-hum sex life. Not sure what to buy? Take a look at my sex toy review site, drdicksextoyreviews.com. It is chock full of swell gift-giving ideas. Look for the Dr. Dick's Stockroom banner in the sidebar of my site. Until next week, remember, sex is good, and good sex? Why, that's even better. Over and out.